Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. I'm glad you're here for episode 3 of Found Objects podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. This is a history podcast, and I am elated to share the news that we have hit number 3 on the history charts. On the charts for podcasts under history, we are number 3. It's just crazy. I mean, I guess, yeah, it's our third week. We're number 3. I mean, I don't even know where to begin. I don't know what to say. I am absolutely speechless. I can't believe the reception thus far. It's been so encouraging to me because I've lived with this insane degree of imposter syndrome my entire life, especially as it pertains to like social media stuff and my career. And, you know, I always feel in the back of my mind, like even when I'm succeeding at something, I'm like, but what happens if I fail in, you know, X years or whatever? I'm always predicting the crash and burn. I'm just so out of words. I don't even know what to say. I have no idea what to say except for thank you so much for your listens and your love. I see you. I hear you. I appreciate you so much. Thank you for letting me tell my stories, and thanks for loving them. I mean, that's great. And we have so many good ones to come. Like every time I come up with a new story and send it to my researcher, Sarah, and we geek out over it, I just get even more excited to share it with you guys and eventually read it and share it. So you guys, we have like, I think the next 8 episodes selected, like episode topics selected and researched, and I just have to sit down and record them all. So that's my task currently, is just getting them all recorded. And then, of course, every Wednesday at 6 a.m., they come out. So right when you wake up, you'll have a companion. I mean, unless you wake up at 5 a.m., can't help you then. 6 a.m. just felt right for me to post them. So yeah. Anyway, I digress. I want to get into this episode because we are talking about a very remarkable woman from history today. And it's kind of a crazy story. And I'm very excited to share it because it's very culturally relevant. If you listen to a particular music artist that is crushing it right now, that, how do I like describe her without saying who it is? I mean, it's going to be obvious in like 0.2 seconds, but you know, she's one of my favorite artists, and the fact that she's coming out with this new album and it references a woman from history and she's done this before, of course I had to do some research, do some digging. And yeah, I guess without further ado, let's roll the music. Let's get into the story so I can get this off my chest and tell you guys who I'm talking about, because I can't keep a secret. If there's one thing you need to know about me, well, besides the fact that I'm really bad at math, you already know that, I can't keep a secret. So let's get into the episode, shall we? Think back to February 4th of this year. I know, like a month ago, which feels like a lifetime ago, but it was about a month ago, I guess, as I'm recording this, February the 4th. Taylor Swift stood on stage and announced that she was releasing a new album, shocking everybody. No one expected that. Everyone expected her to say she was re-recording and releasing Reputation, Taylor's version. Instead, she shocked the masses by saying she was releasing a new album called The Tortured Poets Department, coming out on April 19th, which I am just counting down the days. I love Taylor Swift. Say what you want about Taylor Swift. If you don't like her, you'll still like this episode, I promise. During her acceptance speech, she announced that this album was coming out, and then she subsequently posted the track list for the album, The Tortured Poets Department. Based on the track list, one could assume relatively easily that it's a breakup album of sorts, but there was one song on there that stuck out to me, and I was like, you know what? I want to do some digging on this one. I was just intrigued as I went down the track list, and I landed on one that just didn't sound like the others. It was a name, and the name was Clara Bow. And it's a largely unknown name in this day and age, but upon some further investigation, which of course we've done, she's a woman with a story. Guys, Clara Bow, she was this silent film star, the embodiment of a 1920s flapper, a woman involved in scandal after scandal, but most importantly, a girl who just wanted to be unapologetically herself. And I know when you hear that line, you're like, oh, it's so cliche, you know, oh, unapologetically herself, whatever. But guys, like, you will not believe this story that I'm about to tell you. It's very interesting. And it also really, once you get to know Clara Bow in this story, it will make more sense why Taylor chose to highlight her in this album. And while we have no idea, like at this point where I'm sitting here right now, what day is it? It is March 14th, 2024. So a month away from the album release, a month and like 5 days or something. So I have no idea what the song is actually going to be like, what it's going to sound like, what she's going to say in the song, but one could imagine that she might be drawing parallels between her life and this flapper's life. So yeah, we'll wrap up at the end and talk about it, talk about our thoughts on it. But I want to tell you guys this story and just go through the tale, the life and triumphs and failures of Clara Bow, because it's all very interesting. So before Clara was a woman so famously embroiled in fame and in scandal, she had a very troubling childhood to contend with. And this is a good moment for me to announce a trigger warning, suicide, and some mentions of abuse. Born in Brooklyn in 1905, Clara was not popular, nor the subject of envy, as she was in later years, which we'll get to. She was just a young girl trying to keep her head above water. Her family was in the throes of poverty for most of her young life, and she had two siblings, but she was the only one to survive past infancy. To cope with this, which I can imagine must have been so hard on her parents, her father turned to alcohol, and her mother wallowed in the depths of severe mental illness. So that meant Clara had to single-handedly contend with her father's abusive behavior and his drunken benders while also trying to support her ill mother, which it just sounds like it was hard on the entire family. I mean, having to be a caretaker when you are a child is just so unfair, yet it happens, I mean, even to this day, and it's just so sad to hear about. But Clara, she was a strong girl, and we'll see that throughout this story. Clara sought refuge from her rat-infested, abusive home at the movies. As a teenager, she was actually part of the first generation of adolescents to have the privilege of escaping to the movies. She was enthralled by the way a movie could make your troubles fade away, even if for a short time, so she went any chance she got. And even looking back on my own life, like, I remember how much freedom I felt when I was really young and like going to the movies. Like, my parents would drop me and my friends off at the movies, and like that was like our one time to kind of be out in public unsupervised, and it was liberating. It was like a very cool thing. So I can imagine Clara felt a very similar way, and it was a good escape from her troubled household. So that was when her love for films and acting began. When Clara was 16, she entered into a fame and fortune contest put on by Motion Picture Magazine, and the prize was literally a part in an upcoming film called Beyond the Rainbow. She knew it was a long shot. She had no formal training of any sort and really no money, but she had the passion, the drive, and the confidence to make it happen. It was her dream, after all. After going to the movies, she was like, this is what I am meant to do. And so she went for it. Her mother was not so supportive of her acting career and was highly objectionable. So much to her dismay, Clara had to seek the help of her abusive father to get a new dress and the photographs required for entry. In fact, she actually entered the contest without her mom knowing. To everyone's surprise, including her own, Clara somehow won the contest. And then, as they promised, she was invited on set to fill a small role in Beyond the Rainbow. She was ecstatic, of course, but her mother was not so much. She thought actresses were no better than whores. Pardon my French. Even worse, Clara woke up one morning to find her mother standing over her with a butcher's knife, mumbling about the woes of an acting career. Clara claimed that her mom had said, "I'd rather see you dead than as an actress." Luckily, for the sake of Clara's safety and all, her mother was then institutionalized shortly after this incident. But very sadly, she was never released and later passed away during treatment. In an effort not to let her mother's perspective rain on her parade, Clara invited some of her friends and classmates to a screening of her movie. She was so excited. I mean, imagine, like, you won this contest by a stroke of luck and, you know, you're gonna finally see your movie in theaters. And of course, you gather a little group of people to go. You're so excited. She goes to the theater with all of her friends, only to find out that her role had been cut. As you can imagine, the ridicule of this, of being cut and getting all of your friends to go, like, oh my God, I can't imagine that feeling. It kind of reminds me of that one episode of Friends when Joey invites his grandma over to watch him in like a soap opera or something, and his role got cut. And so they had to like pretend and like make a fake movie so his grandma wouldn't know that his role had been cut and like get upset over it. And she only speaks Italian. I don't know. That was like an old episode. But anyway, it would be very sad, especially for this girl, this young girl who doesn't have the support of her family. Like, she doesn't have the support of her parents. And she finally has something going for her. And it got cut. And that's probably embarrassing, but also just sad and kind of knocks you down a peg and makes you feel like your dreams aren't valid. So the ridicule for Clara, it was almost too much to bear. Almost. When Clara contemplated her life, she knew she deserved more than the tenements of Brooklyn had to offer. So she dusted herself off and tried again, which is very remarkable. Like, a lot of people, when they fail one time at whatever they're trying to do that might be out of their comfort zone, will just throw in the towel and give up. So it's very impressive that even at a young age, like, she kept going. So she got back out there. She started auditioning for roles at various New York studios because she'd had this taste of what an actress could be like when she was on set, even though her role got cut. She had that taste. She got a small slice of it and she wanted the whole pie. She wanted to fight to make it happen. Clara's second chance at acting came in 1922 for the silent film Down to the Sea in the Ships. It was a drama about the whaling industry. She played the role of a stowaway on the ship, acting as a tomboy, and this is where her natural acting abilities really began to shine, because she really was a tomboy. She played roles as herself and really let it all out there in front of the camera, which is how she stole the hearts of production teams, directors, and viewers instantly. Before she knew it, Clara had 4 films under her belt in New York. She was making enough money to, 1, support her deadbeat dad, and 2, justify a move to Hollywood. She knew that to make this happen and to continue with the momentum, she needed to ditch the New York studios and head to the big leagues. So in 1923, that is exactly what she did. Clara packed up her life and joined Preferred Pictures in California, headed by producer B.P. Schulberg. And a fun fact for you, she was famously signed by him after just one meeting due to her ability to cry on command. She later said in an interview that all she had to do was think of home, which just like stabs you in the heart when you think about it. Like, she just had to think of her terrible family life and her mom passing away in an institution and her dad, like all of this just family turmoil, her siblings passing away, and then she could just cry on command. Preferred Pictures, which was the studio that she chose to go to, unfortunately was known for producing low-budget, bottom-of-the-barrel productions. Schulberg was also monetizing Clara's success and only giving her a fraction of the earnings. But in her eyes, she didn't care. She'd gotten out of New York, she was pursuing her dreams, someone had given her a shot. That's all that mattered to her. So she quickly racked up more films, including Black Oxen, which was a 1923 film, Grit in 1924, Wine in 1924, The Plastic Age in 1925, and Dancing Mothers, 1926. So she was working, she was booked and busy. And back then she was considered box office gold. Dancing Mothers, one of those films I just listed, was actually produced by none other than Paramount Pictures. A couple years into her blossoming career in Hollywood, Preferred Pictures went out of business, so Schulberg and Clara were acquired by Paramount. While she was pumping out movies like crazy, sometimes working on 4 or 5 at one time, this was the best thing that could have happened to Clara, because Paramount teamed up with Eleanor Glynn on the production of a silent film called It. She was essentially the Candace Bushnell, so author of the more modern Sex and the City, of the 1900s. So Eleanor, she tackled those taboo subjects like sexuality before there were even socially approved words to describe them. She was a progressive feminist author who pushed the boundaries of gender roles with each piece that she published. In 1907, Eleanor wrote something called 3 Weeks, which spun the tale of an older woman seducing a younger man in the hopes of conceiving a child. Which might not sound super groundbreaking to us now, but this was insane back then, because topics of pregnancy, menstruation, and sex, these were never discussed. And even when they were, it was always behind closed doors. Like, it wouldn't be something out in the open that would be so public, like a written work or a movie. Enter It. And when I say It, I'm referring to the title of the book by Eleanor Glynn, and then eventually it would become a silent film. By the 1920s, Eleanor Glynn had moved on from strictly writing and was the resident love and sex expert in Hollywood. When she released It, her novella, Paramount Pictures snatched it right up. Rightfully so. It was a punchy tale for the time about a sales girl who has a crush on the upper-class manager of the department store where she works. Paramount purchased the rights for $50,000 back then, which is almost $900,000 today, and then proposed an idea to Eleanor Glynn. What if Clara Bow has, quote, it? And what if we turn it into a movie and make her the star? It was groundbreaking for women of this time to see a movie that empowered women to pursue a man, not the other way around. The 1927 movie, It, focused on women looking, wanting, and acting with sexual freedom, which was just completely unheard of. It was the culmination of a path toward accepted, celebrated sexuality at a time when women were still pushing for equality. And Clara Bow was the face of the movement. She was the It girl. Not only that, but Clara's magnetism and electric, sexy performances spoke to the flapper persona of the times. After all, flappers were a cultural phenomenon in and of themselves in the 1920s. They were essentially, a little bit of a definition here, they were women who wore short dresses, shocking, bobbed their hair, extra shocking, and embraced the freedom from traditional societal constraints, which was just sheer blasphemy. They pushed boundaries and challenged stereotypical gender barriers. They engaged in activities deemed unladylike at the time, like attending social events without chaperones, smoking and drinking in public, and being more open about discussing, as well as engaging in, sex. Due to the box office success of It with Clara Bow at the helm as the leading lady, she became the hot ticket item for movie producers. If you wanted a movie to succeed as a producer, you would hire Clara. So she was also recruited in 1927 to co-star in a big budget World War I film called Wings. In fact, they rewrote the script for her. That's how bad they wanted her in it. It was a colossal success and played for 63 straight weeks at the Criterion Theater in New York City. At $2 per ticket, the movie was racking in the big bucks back then. This movie went on to make cinematic history when it won the very first Oscar for Best Picture. And while the movie was objectively a huge hit, I mean, it won the very first Oscar for Best Picture, for crying out loud, and it played for 63 straight weeks, and, you know, this was a hit of a movie, Clara still, you know, was honest with herself in the media. She knew that her role really was just a pretty face in this film. Like, that was why she was cast, and that was why her role succeeded. Like, she was this pretty face, and she was aware of that. She was the arm candy in this male-centric film. A box office magnet, And for that reason, she reportedly hated her, quote, girl next door character in this film and regretted the pointless nudity in the movie, even once calling herself, quote, the whipped cream on top of the pie. Needless to say, Clara had some life-altering roles in 1927, whether she loved them or not. And now she was officially in the public eye. For a time, she was receiving more fan mail per week than a town of 5,000 people. She found herself inexplicably drawn to her, quote, fan friends, as she called them. She took great pride in inspiring their confidence and femininity. She stayed true to herself. And in fact, Clara's Wings co-star Richard Arlen once said, quote, she was the biggest star we had, and she was the last to know it. She remained the tomboy from Brooklyn, which endeared her to the public, but made her an outcast with the Hollywood elite. And because Clara wasn't accepted or well-liked among other women in the film colony, the gossip machine started churning. Even Schulberg, Clara's producer, like the person that is supposed to like be on her side, that is kind of profiting off of Clara's success, played into the gossip by calling her Crisis a Day Clara. Some think she didn't actually realize that she was stirring the pot. She was just being herself. But in hindsight, she was exhibiting some odd behaviors. For example, Clara was invited to a dinner with a director at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and she showed up in a bathing suit and high heels. She disregarded the dress code for dinner and the Beverly Hills Hotel, yet she could not understand for the life of her why anyone would care what she wore to dinner. She was also reluctantly offered an invite to a famous Eddie Sutherland and Louise Brooks party, which was known for attracting big-name actors, but her behavior was so similarly, quote, mortifying to them that invitations quickly ceased after that. Clara's attempt to haphazardly keep up with the Joneses led to a very public breakdown on the set of Rough House Rosie at the end of 1927. For years, Clara had battled chronic insomnia and the rumblings of mental health issues that she had turned a blind eye to. She didn't have time to work on herself when her career was at her height, or at its height. Even more concerning was her fear of admitting that she could be exhibiting behaviors that were all too familiar, behaviors like her mother's. So, pause here. People in Hollywood think she's nuts, and she's also, like, not taking care of herself and her mental health. She's doing way too many movies at once and burning herself out and having meltdowns on set. It just sounds like her life is in a certain chaos at this point in our story. And, you know, the part about her talking about how she doesn't feel like other people in Hollywood like her is kind of reminiscent of our girl Taylor Swift. Like, I feel like that might be something she'll kind of dig into in her rendition, in her song called Clara Bow. I wonder, because, you know, that's something she's talked about before, like the Kanye West of it all. To add to her stress, her deadbeat freeloader father moved to Hollywood to join her, of course, because of course he did. Like, you know, his daughter is single-handedly supporting him, and he's now going to get closer to her and just continue to mess her life up. Like, he was abusive to her as a child, didn't help his wife out, which then, you know, resulted in Clara having to become that parent figure as a child to her own parents. He moved in with her once she was rich and lived off of her money. Plus, his alcoholism only snowballed, which directly impacted her image in the public eye as well. He was a malignant force and a constant pebble under her shoe. So back to Clara's burnout. So she was, you know, working these crazy hours, burning out, having meltdowns, as one would. Like, I would certainly have a meltdown if I was doing like four movies at once and people in Hollywood in the industry hated me and tabloids were saying mean things about me. Like, I would have a breakdown as well. So in an attempt to remedy her breakdown and burnout, Paramount gave Clara a 3-month, quote, vacation. And while she may have gotten a break from work and doing all of her silent films, her social life didn't stop. In fact, her romantic relationships at this point were plastered across gossip columns and were the front page of newspapers worldwide. But she made no attempt to conceal her men. Clara very publicly discussed her, quote, engagements with various men in Hollywood. Another Taylor Swift parallel here. It was no secret that engagements was also a euphemism for men she was sleeping with. But of course, you know, back then it was a bit more taboo to say things like that. As the most famous woman in Hollywood at the time, there was no shortage of men waiting outside her door to be considered as someone to have an engagement with, quote, engagement. This is likely why Hollywood fan magazines like Photoplay dubbed her as the girl who, quote, burns them up and leaves them cold. Clara had quite the roster, so to speak. She fell for Gilbert Roland, her co-star in The Plastic Age. She fell for Victor Fleming, the director of her film Mantrap. He went on to famously direct The Wizard of Oz and Gone with the Wind in 1939. You might have heard of those films. I've seen both of them. No wonder she fell for his intellect, charisma, and talent. She then also fell for Gary Cooper, her co-actor in both It and Wings, a budding star in his own right. Clara even voluntarily did a comprehensive confessional-style interview where she discussed her family's history with mental illness, her childhood in the slums of Brooklyn, and her insecurities amongst the Hollywood elite. And apparently, it was a bit too raw and real for readers. It was a written interview. They wanted a happy rise to fame story, not her reality. And frankly, this was the root of why being her acquaintance, let alone her friend, was considered social suicide in Hollywood. Again, the parallels to Taylor Swift they're just continuing as we go. Despite her public romantic life and questionable status among the acting community, Paramount pegged Clara as their top choice to debut one of their first, quote, talkies in 1929. So we've entered the part of our story now when movies have sound. Like, up until this point, all the movies that Clara's been in have been silent films. Like, up until 1929, all the films that I've listed that she's been in are all silent films. Now we've entered the talkie era. Paramount knew the public appeal that Clara possessed. So, of course, they wanted her face connected to the new ventures, to this new era of movies, which I'm assuming, I mean, I didn't do much research into, you know, the whole talkies versus silent film era in time. But I can imagine it was kind of a shock for people at first, you know, like going from not hearing dialogue and kind of just having to use their imagination and pay attention to the cues of people on screen and like what they're doing to kind of figure out what's going on. You know, it's crazy that I wonder if people at first were like, we don't like this new style of film with the sound, like, because people tend to be pretty averse to change. Like, at first when something comes out, you're like, oh, I don't know about that. And then it's like the norm 5 years later or less than that. So I wonder how it went down with, you know, viewers. But anyway, I digress. Actually, a fun fact that I want to share about Clara Bow. So she is widely credited as the reason why boom mics were born. Clara was notorious for moving around a movie set like a bull in a china shop, which was great for silent films. Like, she'd flail around, do all this crazy stuff, but it posed a problem for talkies. To pick up her voice on the microphone, director Dorothy Arzner rigged a microphone to a fishing rod just for Clara, just so it would work for her films. Hence, the boom mic was born. That's crazy. Like, I've used boom mics before for things I've done. Like, I've done productions, you know, for various projects I've done in my life. And I had no idea that the first rendition was a fishing rod. Did you know? Now you do. And if you don't know what a boom mic is, it's like one of those mics that you hold kind of up in the air over an actor's head. And it's cut out of the frame, so you don't see it. But it's like kind of hanging right just like an inch or two above where the frame cuts off on the top of your TV or wherever you're watching. And it gets that audio without you having to wear a microphone or something like visible in shot. So this was the first rendition of a boom mic. How crazy is that? Clara did that. So Clara was given 2 weeks to prepare for the transition from body acting to voice acting. Which is interesting, body acting. So body acting was the silent film way of doing things, and then voice acting, of course, for the talkies. While it was widely assumed that her Brooklyn accent gave her some grief, like people were like, you know, not used to hearing her speak, and she had this thick Brooklyn accent, it actually was not a career-ending problem. So a lot of articles you'll see these days, I've actually read a few of them, and Sarah has debunked, it's like, people said that that was the real issue, why Clara had a bit of a hard time adjusting to the new kinds of films. But it wasn't that at all. It wasn't her Brooklyn accent. It was actually her microphone fright. She had no stage background or theatrical training. And because it was a talkie and not a silent film where they weren't using the audio, like, you know, in a silent film, a director could kind of talk her through what she was doing, like out loud while she's doing it and kind of coach her. But in a talkie, they can't do that, you know, quiet on set. So this scared her quite a lot. Clara was worried she would flop and all the work she'd done to make a name for herself would end once they heard her speak. Her talent was in her relatable facial expressions, her over-the-top body movements. So she was right to be worried. Like, her life as she knew it hung on her talkie film being a success. So at this point in time, Clara had been in 46 silent films. But the world heard her speak, heard her voice for the very first time in the 1929 film, The Wild Party. So Clara was feeling a lot of pressure from all angles at this point. At this time in our story, the country was dealing with the Wall Street crash of 1929 that led to the Great Depression. Americans, who were once fascinated by the glitz of Hollywood, were now appalled by celebrities' extravagant lifestyles, especially Clara's. She was known to spend obscene amounts of money on gambling, booze, which was illegal to purchase and sell at the time, and parties. Her popularity wavered as people felt like she was acting with enormous insensitivity towards normal people and their struggles at that time. However, after years of supposed illicit behavior and men warming her bed, Clara met her knight in shining armor, Western actor Rex Bell. They met in 1930 on the set of True to the Navy, and not only was he her lover, he was her protector, which is exactly what she needed during a time of public turmoil. They had this whirlwind romance and married in 1931, just 1 year after they met. I want to pause here, because if you care about Taylor Swift and, you know, her ex, Joe Alwyn, and that story, remember when, I mean, she went through all that public scrutiny and then disappeared for a year. No one saw her, no one photographed her and whatnot, and she just, like, disappeared and hung out with Joe for a year. I wonder if in the song, she'll kind of draw parallels to her, you know, her knight in shining armor being Joe at the time, Rex Bell being Clara's knight in shining armor in 1930. You know, she was going through, she's being dragged in the public eye, and then Rex Bell kind of swooped in and was her protector. So maybe she might, this might be a positive song on Taylor's album, and it's like talking about how Joe, like, did help her in a time where she was, you know, not getting great headlines, but I don't know. Like, I'm really intrigued to see where she goes with this song, but it'll be good to have this background of, like, who was Clara Bow, right? Like, it'll be helpful for us. And I can't wait to, like, you know, debrief once it comes out, we can chat about it. Anyway, so back to the story. So they got married. That's where we were. That's where we left off. In 1931, Clara and Rex had this whirlwind romance and married that year, like in 1931, which was just 1 year after they met. The timing of Rex as the guardian angel in Clara's life could not have been more perfect, because the biggest scandal of all was right around the corner, and it involved Clara's assistant, Daisy DeVoe. Daisy DeVoe was many things, but she was first and foremost one of Clara's best friends, which she didn't have a lot of, okay? Because remember, she gets scrutinized and dragged through the public often. She was this loud feminist woman who talked about sex, and, you know, she didn't have many friends. So saying that Daisy DeVoe was, like, one of her closest friends is like saying she was her best friend. They met on the set of It, where Daisy was Clara's hairdresser. And they were close in age, had similar interests, and bonded over the fast-paced film industry. Once It wrapped, the girls were inseparable, and Daisy saw an opportunity to help get Clara's affairs in order. It was no secret that Clara's life, personally and financially, was a mess. She rose to fame so quickly and had no idea how to be financially literate. She grew up dirt poor and didn't know how to adjust to, like, getting all this money out of nowhere. So Daisy stepped in and offered to become her assistant and financial manager. As Teat Carl, Paramount's publicist, once said, quote, she figured Clara needed a strong-armed dame to take charge, so she appointed herself. And for a time, things were actually great with this arrangement. Daisy helped Clara with domestic tasks like shopping and cleaning, but also managed to balance her books, get her mortgage paid off, and set up a trust fund. Under Daisy's direction, Clara's bank account grew to almost $250,000 back then, which is a lot nowadays. I didn't calculate that specific one, but it was a lot. However, all of this considered, all these grand things that Daisy did for Clara, and, you know, they seemed to be friends, there's always, you know, the consideration, that age-old saying of like, you shouldn't mix work and play. It can get messy, which it did in this scenario. When Clara started dating Rex, it became very clear very quickly that Rex and Daisy butted heads. Basically, Rex feared that Daisy had ill intent when managing Clara's finances. Like, he thought something shady might be going on there, and Clara was just too trustworthy. Daisy feared that Rex was forcing Clara to misappropriate her funds for his benefit. So, that on the other side of things, like, Daisy had suspicions about Rex. Like, both of them kind of thought the other one was doing something shady towards Clara. So both had suspicions that they just couldn't shake. Daisy claims that she was so wholeheartedly distrusting in Rex that her goal to protect Clara's assets from him is what drove her to then steal Clara's checkbooks, business papers, personal love letters, and telegrams. Yeah. So Daisy thought that if she took them to her safety deposit box, Rex wouldn't be able to access them. Clara's things. Like, she stole Clara's things, and she claimed that her end game was to never keep Clara from her own personal property. Like, she was gonna, you know, give it back to her. All this, like, we don't really know, shady stuff. But Rex retaliated by taking matters into his own hands. He fired Daisy when he found out about all this stuff, that she was, like, taking stuff from Clara and, like, putting it in her own safe and whatnot. So Rex fired Daisy and locked her out of Clara's Beverly Hills home due to suspicion of theft. This is when things spiraled out of control. Daisy, in her distraught haze, resorted to blackmail. After Rex kicked her out and fired her, even though she, like, seemed to maybe have Clara's best interests at heart, like the reason why she tucked away all these personal things, I don't know why she stole the love letters. I think that's very, very strange and shady. But maybe, like, keeping the checkbook away from him, like, if she's really suspicious and considers herself a good friend, like, maybe I can understand that. But, like, keeping Clara's love letters was very weird of her, and I don't know why she did that. But anyway, now that Clara was kicked out, like, Rex kicked her out, she started to spiral out of control. She felt helpless, and Rex had, you know, taken her best friend away from her, pretty much, and her job, and then cut off all contact between her and Clara. Daisy went to Clara's attorney, W.I. Gilbert, and demanded $125,000. And that, a lot of money back then, a lot of money now. And this was no random sum. It was about half of Clara's trust fund, which Daisy felt entitled to since she was the primary reason it grew to that large value in the first place. If Clara refused, Daisy would then release the explosive love letters and telegrams. So, blackmail. As Daisy said, one more slam in the papers and Clara's through with the pictures. So she figured, because Clara had already kind of had this bad rep at the time for being extravagant during this tough financial time for Americans, that she was like, perfect. It's like, I'll blackmail Clara. And because she's already going through it in the tabloids, like, she won't be able to handle another blow, so she'll give me this money. Some friend, I must say. Apparently, after all this, after coming on so strong with the threats, though, Daisy circled back the very next day with her tail between her legs, because she knew that she had acted irrationally, but the damage was already done. In Clara's eyes, the threat was unforgivable. So the simple misunderstanding had now grown to a criminal matter. Both girls had burned the bridge, and it was game on. So they did end up going to trial over this. And Daisy, let's just say, I'm not a big fan. Okay, so while Daisy was indicted on 37 counts of grand theft and was put on trial in January of 1931, you would have thought that Clara was the one on the stand, that Clara was the one facing charges. Daisy and her legal counsel had entered all the, quote, stolen property into evidence, and they took every opportunity to showcase them in the courtroom. Like, the way that they paraded all of these very personal letters and telegrams and things that, like, again, at the time, like, Clara was this woman who was a little bit racy for the times, okay? And so they were parading all of this evidence, quote, evidence around and making her look bad. And it almost seemed like, if you read the documents and look through how it went, it almost seems like Clara was the one in trouble when Daisy had done the crime. Like, Daisy had stolen from Clara, and yet Clara was getting dragged through the mud. They read private telegrams between Rex and Clara. They carefully deciphered every single transaction in her bank books, like talking about all the stuff she was spending her money on. They defamed Clara in this trial to no end. And Daisy falsely recalled Clara's, quote, spending orgies, lesbianism, incest, gambling, and drug addiction as well. Just to add color to the picture of the truth. You know, these are not true. And she's just trying to make Clara look like a bad person, which none of these things makes a person a bad person. But again, like, this is a different time. The best part is that it turns out Daisy was in fact stealing money from Clara. She was literally stealing money from Clara. Like, before she even asked for this 125 grand, she was stealing money. She stole all this stuff from Clara, but was only found guilty on one count of theft and was sentenced to 18 months in the county jail. As Judge Doran stated in his sentencing, quote, the evidence in this case discloses that you conducted a systematic raid on funds that were entrusted to you. The jury was quite generous and evidently quite sympathetic because they only found you guilty of one count. That was their prerogative, but certainly the evidence was abundant and sufficient to support a conviction on all counts. So what I'm getting from this is, like, the judge was like, I see right through you, but still. But of course, even after that, even after the judge pretty much just said, like, you are guilty, we're being generous and only giving you this amount of time, but, like, you're guilty and it's obvious, the press only latched on to the stuff that Daisy said that was a lie. Like, of course, they ran with the lies. That sentence of Clara's spending orgies, her lesbianism, incest, gambling, and drug addiction. Like, those are the things. Those were not true about Clara. And yet the press ran with those things and splashed them all over the place. And this was something that could never be undone. This tarnished Clara's reputation, her image, forever. They used this as fodder to take her down. And in 1931, Frederick Journeau, publisher of a weekly tabloid called The Coast Reporter, even went to jail for salacious comments and fabrications taken from Daisy's accounts regarding her character and sending obscene material through the mail. So one of the tabloid publishers, because of the way he was talking about Clara, he was literally sent to jail for these things because it was so nasty. And this broke Clara. All of this, you know, losing her close friend, and then being dragged through the tabloids, through the media, with all of these falsehoods, this broke her, rightfully so. I feel like this would be too much for really anyone to handle. So Clara checked herself into Glendale Sanatorium to help combat the latest bout of mental health issues that crept up amidst the drama. And she was only 25 at this time. She was young to go through all of this, like, and to have to deal with this, like, on her own. I mean, she has Rex, of course, as a sounding board, as this knight in shining armor, but, like, you know, it still gets to you, and you kind of feel alone. So upon her return from the sanatorium, Clara pretty much severed ties with anyone connected to her life in Hollywood. She broke ties with Paramount. Rex, on the other hand, so, you know, he was her co-star, and now it's her husband. You know, it's hard to say whether or not he was really a guardian angel for her during this time, but what matters is that Clara loved him and trusted him. Either way, Rex didn't really want to be a part of the Hollywood scene anymore either, which was great for her because, you know, she was stepping away, and it was nice that her partner was also on board with that. So they actually, this is interesting, they moved away from Hollywood to become ranchers. They wanted a more private, sheltered life. And, you know, Rex wanted to be a rancher, but he also wanted to see Clara well and not being torn apart by vultures in the press. So that's what they did. They purchased a ranch in Searchlight in Northern Nevada as a deserved reprieve and got away from it all. And things were great for a time. Clara got much needed time away from the public eye and plenty of R&R, but movies were still on her mind. You know, this was still something that she was passionate about, even though she didn't like the negative parts of it, like the tabloids and, you know, the fame that came along with it. But she loved the art. She loved the craft. And funny enough, so in the same vein of their love for films, Rex and Clara named their ranch Walking Box Ranch as a tribute to camera boxes in Hollywood. And even if you look at the brand and logo for the ranch, it's a silhouette of a camera box. And I actually didn't know what a camera box was specifically. I had to read about it, look it up. And it's essentially a simple camera, like a very simple camera used in the late 19th and 20th centuries. And it's typically a cardboard or plastic box with a lens on one end and film on the other. So it was no surprise when she was quickly convinced to come back to Hollywood. Fox Studios enticed Clara with a fat check, and, you know, that coupled with the fact that she was just very passionate about the industry, or at least the films, she was back. She realized that in her absence, the press had not been particularly gracious about her quick exit. In fact, they said that Clara was, quote, giving in to the pressure and throwing in the towel. So she returned to prove them wrong. This is when she took a stab at some more serious roles, but she just wasn't garnering the crowds that she once had. The allure, the magnetism on the screen was there, but it just wasn't being received like her earlier silent films. She knew quickly that her heart just wasn't in it anymore, and the audiences had moved on. So she called it quits after her film Hoopla in 1933. She was just 28 years old. Rex, her husband, was supportive as ever, so back to the ranch they went. Like, she tried it again, she took a stab, and then she retreated again to the ranch. And that's when she all but disappeared from the public eye. She and Rex eventually had two sons, Tony in 1934 and George in 1938, and reports said that she really leaned into the domestic lifestyle. For the most part, she flew under the radar for years. Clara reemerged in Hollywood in 1937 for a brief time to open the It Cafe, a restaurant in the Plaza Hotel, to try and recapture and memorialize the success of her movie It. And the restaurant was generally successful, though it ran without her assistance until it closed in 1943. Her last public venture was a mystery guest on a popular radio show called Truth or Consequences, and she was the mystery voice in the show's Mrs. Hush contest. As the years went on, Clara became more withdrawn and reclusive. She was in the throes of mental illness and insomnia, and Rex eventually decided to re-enter public life on his own to hopefully recapture a sense of purpose in their otherwise quiet, sometimes sad and hard life. This time, though, his goal was not acting. It was politics. And Rex got in and got involved. He was invested in this new political career. However, in 1944, when Rex ran for the U.S. House of Representatives, Clara, I have chills reading this, she attempted to commit suicide via overdose. Oh, like chills, guys, I have chills. A note was found in which Clara stated that she preferred death to a public life, which I guess it could be assumed that, like, if Rex had gotten to the House of Reps, like, he would become a public figure again, and, like, she would as well, and, like, I guess there were fears there. So while Clara survived the attempt, it became clear to her and her family in the years following that she needed professional help again. In 1949, Clara admitted herself to the Institute of Living in Connecticut, and she stayed there for a long period of time and tried every type of therapy and treatment under the sun. It was commendable how dedicated Clara was to fixing her issues. She was never forced. It was all self-initiated, even when her past came back with a vengeance. Analysts today tied the onset of the illness as well as her insomnia to the butcher knife incident with her mother in 1922. Eventually, she was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Upon her eventual departure from the Institute, Clara did not return to the ranch to be with Rex and her family. She instead moved into a small home in Culver City by herself. Sources differ on whether or not this was the end of her marriage with Rex, but whether they made it official legally or not, they separated at this point in time. And Clara lived a humble, quiet life under the constant care of a nurse, Estella Smith, until her death in 1965, 3 years after Rex's sudden death. And at the time of Clara's passing, her estate was worth about $500,000, so $4,900,000 in 2024, which is a lot of money. And yet she lived this simple, reclusive life in Culver City. I don't know what became of her children. Doesn't seem like she spent much time with them. I mean, she was just going through it mentally. Clara ended her acting career so early in her life and then disappeared so completely that people literally forgot about her. Plus, the movies she was in disappeared from the public eye as well. It's really interesting, actually. Like, I didn't know this, but the silent film industry, like the catalog of silent films, Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation estimates that more than 90% of American films produced before 1929 are lost. And the Library of Congress estimates that 75% of all silent films are lost forever. So Clara went off the grid and her films along with her. So it was a twofold disappearing act. But in recent years, there has been an attempt to restore her legacy. Clara Bow was an icon. She was the picture of the modern independent woman, although she was misunderstood. You know, she was the girl, or woman rather, that walked into the Beverly Hills Hotel in her bathing suit to have dinner. You know, she was different for sure, but she was a star, and so many things were invented because of her, you know? She could make herself cry on command. She invented the boom mic. Like, there's so many things tied to this woman, and she's largely forgotten in history. And maybe this is why she's the subject of one of Taylor's new songs from the Tortured Poets Department album. As we all know, Taylor, she's no stranger to memorializing people that she finds fascinating or relatable in her work. Like, a lot of her songs can be tied back to certain people, like Rebecca Harkness, The Holiday House, like all those sorts of things. So, you know, she'll also talk about Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, so many people. You know, I can go on and on. But this is the first time, actually, that Taylor has dedicated an entire song title to a historical figure. And it just makes you wonder, why? What do we think? Like, which parallel is Taylor going to make, if not maybe all of them? I feel like as I was reading this story, like, I would stop and say, like, a few times, like, oh, this is very similar to Taylor's life. Like, I bet she just sees so many similarities in Clara's struggles. I don't know. There's so many different ways that she could take this. It could be a breakup song. It could also be about the tabloids dragging her and, you know, so many men, so little time, like, you know, her having a ton of writing songs about so many different men. And no, I really wonder what she's going to do with this. And, you know, these are all just suspicions on my end, but the parallels between Clara's and Taylor's lives, they're so, so star-crossed. Like, they are, it's uncanny. So the possibilities are endless here. She likely relates to Clara on a deep level, but as we just discussed, like, Clara, like, the latter years of her life were very upsetting, very sad, very reclusive, and, like, not filled with love, it seems. So you almost kind of want or wish that Taylor had been around when Clara was, to kind of just, you know, sit her down and be like, girl, you can't let them win. You can't let them win. You know, if only Clara had someone to tell her, you can't let strangers dictate your life so completely. And you can't, like, I mean, I think that something interesting about Clara's story was, of course, you know, she gave up acting, she moved to the ranch, then she decided she wanted to come back, whether it was because she was getting paid a lot of money or because she was passionate. She did come back for a time, and then she was just kind of not doing well, or it wasn't as explosive of a success as it was in her earlier years, and she gave up. I mean, it happens all the time. I guess the only way that I can personally relate to this is, you know, social media. So I started on social media when I was a teenager, 14 or so. And, you know, it was a slower start. But then when I was kind of in high school and college, like my earlier years in college and later years in high school, I got a lot of popularity online very quickly. And people were obsessed with my videos and a lot of love and a lot of, you know, numbers and follows and watch, you know, just a lot of numbers, a lot of traction for my videos and my content. And then I feel like as I've gotten older, like, things have kind of slowed in certain ways, but that doesn't mean I'm not passionate and I'm not going to continue creating the art. Like, that's why, again, I think I said this in the very first few moments of the episode, but I've gotten into the habit of just creating what I want to create and putting love into it, posting it and ghosting, you know, not focusing on the performance as much as some people might, because it just doesn't do me any good. Like, it's not good for my mental health, and I know that. So yeah, it's just interesting though, that, like, it's hard, it's easier said than done to continue doing something even after you're not received the same way as you were when you were fresh and young and, you know, starting out. But it is really, it's deeply unfair how Clara was treated in the media, all of these falsities just blasted because of this ex-friend of hers that was clearly using her. And it's just, it's very sad. And I wish that she had had a better ending. I really do. But that's life, guys. That's life. And the nature of a lot of these stories I'll be telling you, you know, don't have a happy ending. And that's just, that's how history is sometimes, you know? So anyway, I'm glad that I could give some light to Clara's story, bring her name up again, just another person talking about her, but it's for good reason, because she was a remarkable woman who really challenged the norms and was talented. I watched some clips that still do exist of her, you know, in her prime, and she was just crushing it back then, and I wish that she would have known her potential and just known how great she was, because it doesn't seem like she knew just how great she was and how much people loved her. So anyway, guys, that is the story of Clara Bow, and thank you guys for listening to this episode. Please go to the Instagram Found Objects Podcast and let me know what you thought of this episode on the latest post, which will have some visuals of Clara and the things that I talked about. So definitely check that out and get some visuals in there to complement the story, and let me know what you think of the episode. Follow us on Instagram, follow the podcast so you don't miss an episode every Wednesday, and please rate us 5 stars if you don't mind. And remember, guys, things are not always as they appear. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.